Therapy Insiders is brought to you by Verve, makers of the Arc, a revolutionary neck pain relief and postural support device, available now at www.goarcnow.com, and by Edge Mobility System. Give your mobility the edge. Available at www.edgemobilitysystem.com.
Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Chirac-Abrod here with the dynamic trio of Dr. Joe Palmer, Dr. Ersin Religioso, and our special guest today, you might have heard of him, I don't know, if you're in the PT world. If you haven't, you might have been living under a rock, a quite big one at that, is Dr. Larry Benz. And before we get into all kinds of questions and stories and things like that, I just want to say, Larry, first of all, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to be here. It really is.
It's just too soon. You have quite possibly the best Twitter handle in the physical therapy profession because it literally is at physical therapy. How the heck did you get that Twitter handle?
Well, that's a great question, and I think your audience will be admiring of the story. It's a very true story. So many years ago, I was at a TED conference. You're all familiar with TED,
and he's a good guy. Good guy.
He is a good guy, and he used to host these conferences in Monterey. They eventually moved to Long Beach, and now they're all over the place. But I was one of the original TEDsters, so I was a PT TEDster. And I am in Monterey, and it's after, you know, like 4 or 5 hours of listening to TED Talks, and we're in one of the little pubs there right at the Monterey. They had to move it from Monterey just because the pure size, critical mass of TED got too big for Monterey. But it was very cozy, very comfortable. There's all kinds of, you know, A-listers, B-listers, and then you got folks like me and whoever else, and a lot of technology folks. And I'm literally standing in a bar at this pub, and I'm behind, you know, this is one of these conferences where they put a name tag on you, they put a couple things that you're interested in, and it's all about sort of delisting you, so everybody's just a participant. But curiously enough, so I'm a Kentucky guy, right? I live in Kentucky, grew up in Ohio, but I've been in Kentucky since the mid-80s, and a guy in front of me orders a Maker's Mark bourbon, and so I'm behind him. And that's cool, you know, I get something to talk to him about. He turns around and his name tag is Evan Williams. Now, Evan Williams is the name of a bourbon here in Kentucky.
#BourbonPT.
Yeah, it's a historic bourbon. So I get to chatting with him. I said, this is an unbelievable, I'm not a picture taker, but I'd love to take a picture of a guy named Evan Williams drinking a Maker's Mark beer. I said, Maker's Mark bourbon, because I'm really good friends with the CFO, CEO of Maker's Mark, you know, these small companies, bourbon, Kentucky. And he kind of laughed at it. We started giggling and started a conversation. And he commences to tell me that he had used to be with Google and founded a blogging platform. And then he was one of the co-founders of Twitter. And this was like a week, this is right around the time of South by Southwest, just after that, I think right when Twitter sort of, for lack of a better purpose, kind of launched as a brand. And so we're chatting and he's telling me about the platform. I said, oh, that's kind of neat. And I go back that night, you know, after the event, and I registered for Twitter. I don't know, I was number, I would hate to even admit what number I was on Twitter. And so I had to choose a handle, of course, and I chose @physicaltherapy and proceeded to get to know him a little bit better. And then he went on to, you know, famous things, and Twitter went public. And just as a side note, you guys know John Childs, one of my partners in Evidence in Motion. I came back from that and told him about Twitter, and he bet me a steak dinner at any steakhouse in the United States that they'd be out of business in 18 months. I still have to collect on that. But that's how I got the handle Physical Therapy. And ironically enough, I kind of liked the Twitter thing real early on, and reserved a bunch of different handles, including the handle of Maker's Mark, which I eventually gave, not sold, but I eventually gave to them and some others. So yeah, that's the whole story, and now you know.
So you quite literally had to know one of the founders of Twitter to get that name.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. Well, no, I registered. I'm probably within the first couple hundred. I don't even know the number of registered Twitters. At that time, there was another very similar to Twitter thing called Pawnce, I think, P-O-W-N-C-E or P-A-W-N-C-E. It was almost an identical type of platform, an SMS type platform, and registered for both that evening because somebody else at the thing said, oh yeah, Twitter's like Pawnce or Pawnce is like Twitter or whatever the name was. So I registered for both that evening. I think Pawnce has since been deep sixed, but yeah, that's absolute truth.
Yeah, I've never heard of that, probably for that very reason you just said.
I've never heard of it either.
Yeah.
That's a
definition of early adopter there, Larry.
Yeah,
I've had
I've had a recurrent history of early adoption, even in the cases where I've been the only adopter.
if only you invested in the company early on, into the Twitter handle.
Right, yeah, no, absolutely, yeah.
So you mentioned John Childs and EIM. By the way, John, pay up. Get Larry his steak.
Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit of EIM. And I want to get into, first of all, the program you started in DPT. So we'll at least bring it up and then come back to it, which I think is we'll spend some time on it. But I think most people are well aware of EIM at this point. Joe and Ersin are obviously involved in different ways. But I want to ask you a bit of a different question, not necessarily what it is, because it's been around, it does a lot of courses and things like that and much more than that. But what was that first moment, right, going back where you said, this is something I really am interested in starting, this is what I want to do. And the reason I'm asking that, I did a previous podcast and I talked to three DPT students and a lot of them expressed that interest for entrepreneurial spirit, you know, either opening up a clinic or just doing something. And we've been big on that, pushing that, letting, you know, the PT world know that that's a possibility, that you don't necessarily have to just do the normal clinical stuff, which is nothing wrong with that. But you've done that to a big extreme with EIM and different companies. Did you have any hesitation in the first place? I mean, what made you want to do that? How did it go in the beginning? I know most people that have started businesses know it's not smooth sailing, even though the final result might be more of a polished product.
Yeah, so let me give you the genesis of EIM. And to a certain extent, one of the common themes that will run throughout EIM is this common theme of irreverence, disruption, disrespect, having fun, going against the conventional wisdom. And that's probably the general beginning of it. So I had a company in Kentucky called CORT, Kentucky Orthopedic Rehab Team. We had, you know, a variety of locations in Kentucky. We were the largest private practice in the state, had a bunch of locations in Florida as well, private practice. And I became very concerned because I would go to a neurosurgeon, for example, and he would say, you know, I really like you guys, but why is it when I send somebody to your Preston clinic, they're doing sports medicine kind of stuff, I'd send somebody to your Springhurst location and, you know, you've obviously got somebody with a lot of initials after their last name and they're doing, you know, manipulation. And then I send them to somebody else and they're doing a totally different thing. You know, I like what you do. They're getting better. But I can't understand the inconsistency and the variability of treatment approaches. Now, also keep in mind, this is around the advent of, evidence-based practice, which really was not an American indigenous product. We adopted it essentially from the socialistic countries that had to, you know, weigh the patterns of medical interventions and decide which is the best bang for the buck. So as it became an American phenomenon with the Cochrane database and meta-analysis, and as science sort of got better and evolved into something more mature, we started looking at it and we started saying, well, what is the evidence really now saying about low back pain, for example? That's a, you know, primary driver of referrals to our clinic. And interestingly enough, you know, it was very kind to sort of, you know, manual therapy and exercise. And so I said, I need to deal with this variability issue in a big way. I was also concerned as a business owner that when we'd send people out for continuing education, we'd send them out over a weekend, or we would bring speakers in and we would literally close on a Friday. You know, I'd close 30 locations on a Friday. You can imagine the revenue I lost.
Yeah.
So I started talking to John Childs, who I didn't know very well, but Rob Wehner was a very good friend of mine. We were in the military together. John's a little bit younger than I am. And we started saying, you know, let's distill the evidence in the most common musculoskeletal conditions, cervical pain, lumbar pain, upper extremity pain, lower extremity pain, and therapeutic exercise. And since we're all former military guys, we decided to create an acronym called PEERS. You know, what is the problem? What is the intervention? What is the evidence? And what is the referrals? What should they be generating? So it was it became really an exercise in taking Cochrane and other evidence sources and distilling it towards what we felt were the most common musculoskeletal conditions. And then I said to these guys, I want to level set my company. I want to get everybody operating with this in the same paradigm, the same evaluation framework. I said, but I can't close clinics anymore on Friday. I've got too many locations. I've got too many therapists. And they said, you know, why don't we do this? Why don't we record the videos on this very crude kind of PowerPoint narrative, and then we'll come in on Saturday. And you only need to do it one day because everybody will get kind of these videos and PowerPoints. So that's what we did. So we didn't do this for any business reason. And there's a real lesson there. You don't disrupt because you think there's a business proposition. You disrupt because the marketplace needs something and you use it and you prototype it and you beta test it and you model it. And that's exactly what we did. So we said, you know, we did that for upper extremity. We did that for cervical. And I said to these guys at some point, I said, or keep in mind, these are military guys. These are non-business, you know, guys.
That's what I was going to say. This sounds like a very military-oriented operation.
Yeah, it really was. I said, you know, guys, there's a legitimate business play here. Concurrent with that, the Gallup organization out of Nebraska, everybody knows Gallup polls and all that, they had a healthcare excellence sort of category. And we decided to enter it because what we said was we'll submit them a bunch of data on low back pain, average visits, utilization, days, dollars, duration, outcomes, and we'll show them pre and post sort of the intervention being best practice, being evidence-based practice, and see what that does to our variability and our consistency relative to number of visits, duration, and the like. And so working with that's well beyond my pedigree at this stage. So I'm working with Rob Wehner and John Childs and their PhD status, you know, statistical kind of guys. And so we submitted the data, win the award. I said, guys, there's a legitimate business play here. Let's go to other practices that are just friends and colleagues of mine and level set them based on current best evidence. Now, again, you have to go back in time because EBP was not even an acronym. It was just becoming an acronym. And we're military guys and we love acronyms, right?
So yes, you do.
so we started integrating, and that was really our first product was the PEERS, was the evidence-based algorithms and distilling that information, which then essentially became continuing education under a flipped. It wasn't known as flipped education then. It was known as this is a better efficient way. We'll loop the videos. We'll give you it in advance. We'll let you keep it afterwards. So, you know, we won't waste your time lecturing you at a typical, you know, I'm from the old school where you lecture lab, lecture lab, lecture lab. This was more lab, 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 looped videos of the lectures you've already seen. And that's how we started. So we started with a very flipped education mindset, a very disruptive, again, very, in a sense, irreverent standpoint. We used to say, why is there 220 PT programs all having 220 different radiology programs, pharmacy programs, musculoskeletal orthopedic evaluation programs? And so we sought to find the best, what we determined, you know, through friends and colleagues, the best in class instructors. And so our initial entry in the marketplace was sort of this consulting product, and then it became CE, and then residencies started to become sort of emphasized. And so we said, why don't we do a flipped model, you know, residency, because the typical residents would go to Kaiser, they'd give up 2 years of their life, they'd pack their bags, their, you know, their spouses, their kids, and move on. And, you know, every few residencies that there were then would take one or two students, and then they'd go there and they'd leave. And so we decided that, you know, we felt it was a better model. We felt it made a whole lot more sense, and it was a lot more consistent, a lot more ability to then integrate PhDs and other academic influence. You know, I'm from the old school where private practice people didn't talk to academics.
Was there anything else similar that was going on?
No,
were literally creating a market for a continuing education system that's different from the mold.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly, and that's a great point. So you model it, but then you also create a market. at the same time. And we just felt that the best model was more business to business rather than business to individuals. So if you look at a residency model, I want to do a residency. Okay, I'll move to Kaiser. I'll move to California. I'll do, you know, a great residency. Our model was we're going to go to the best private practices and the best, you know, frontline early adopter companies and say, we're bringing you a residency program to help you train your people in more consistent, less variability, and be able to retain them over a longer period of time with the integration of best, you know, best practices in EVP in it. Exactly.
Did you have any pushback?
Oh, we still have pushback. I talked to a PT program the other day that said, you know, I don't understand you guys. We just don't believe in the flipped brand of education. You guys are arrogant. You guys, we just don't think that's right for the profession. It's like, you know, yeah, that's we get you. We hear you. You know, meanwhile, last week in Chicago, we had a program that was a 1-day program where instead of getting 7 CEUs, they got 14 because they got a bunch of videos and stuff in advance. And then at that particular program, we were able to give them just the hands-on clinical skills. And now instead of a 1-day having be 7 CEUs, they get 14. So we get that you don't like the flipped education. We're very agnostic in terms of where we get the information from. We prefer to be with a combination of PhD PTs who are strongly academic but have an understanding that the clinical practice integration is where the rubber meets the road. And so as private practice folks, we traditionally never talk to the ivory tower academics. In our world, we said, let's collaborate here. Let's create, you know, if we've done anything well, it's really breaking down the walls that exist in our profession between those who talk to one another and those who don't. And we think that starts on the clinical end between academia and private practice.
I'm going to jump in here, Larry, because that's what we found the employees that have gone through your program so far have said that's been the best change, is that they're able to hear a variety of evidence and then defend their position however they decide to interpret that evidence. And I think that's nice. That's along the lines of a more eclectic approach. Pass that off to Urson there.
Yeah. Larry, I think that's great. And, I think what you and John talk a lot about on the blog, I wanted to touch upon in terms of, I think, programs, at least many programs that are stronger in orthopedics, their students are better prepared. It's just that the affiliations are so weak and the schools don't want to, you know, I don't know how to say it, I guess, ruin their contract or give up these contracts of clinicals that the students are coming back from. And, you know, one of the things I always ask students from, because in my old practice when I was busier and I worked more in a practice, they would see residents, they would see fellowship mentees, they would see some of the McKenzie diplomats going for fellowships. So they could see a lot of different trainees and they were exposed to a lot of different PTs at different types of learning and postgraduate learning. And I would always ask them, hey, you know, the next place that you're going to, do they do good care? Do they do manual and exercise? Are they evidence-based? And then they were like, oh, yeah, you know, I called them, and they said they were, because every clinic thinks that they are. You know, every clinic thinks they're amazing, thinks they're evidence-based, and they all do manual therapy. And then the student always comes back 2 weeks later and say, I'm not doing anything. I'm seeing 6 patients every hour, and it's all modalities. And, you know, yeah. How do you think that can change? And people keep on asking me that. I've been out 17 years now, and I haven't really seen a change.
No, it's a very fair question. And again, I'll take a step back and say, our whole emphasis is on disruption and irreverence. So let me begin with that by saying that you're exactly right. The big black hole in the physical therapy training is not the schools. Everybody wants to blame the schools. The big black hole is the internships, is the hope and prayer strategy that the schools have by sending them out to one of any 300 contracts they have. And those 300 plus contracts are there to fulfill their labor needs. And so they feed them to the wolves for the most part. And it's just the variability, you know, that if you really look at the biggest criticism of physical therapy, whether you're talking about CMS, you know, the federal government, third-party payers, is inconsistency and variability. And those are two different constructs. And that begins and ends with the way we train PTs. And we train them by throwing them out to inconsistent, highly variable clinical internships. And so what we've said is that makes absolutely no sense at all. Now, we're fortunate enough that in our early EIM days, both John and Rob and Tim Flynn, you know, again, one of the co-founders of EIM, you know, we had very strong military connections. So we had the Army-Baylor program, and we said to Army-Baylor, you know, instead of having, you know, 150, you know, which is low number for most PT programs, let's eliminate it and go to one contract at 15 facilities. So all your folks will go to those 15 facilities and they'll spend a year there or 6 months there. And so they were willing to do that. So you know, anybody who thinks the government is risk averse is absolutely wrong. They're the ones where, you know, whether it's flying somebody on the moon and landing on the moon to the internet to, you know, doing internships that are a limited number of places in scope, they're the ones that take risk on it because they have no money to really risk. So that's how we really, you know, founded the concept. And then we set another very, very inquisitive, you know, type of approach. And we said, why is it that when we send therapists out for their internship that we completely unhinge them from the school? So I go to the school and now I am on an internship and I'm no longer in an academic environment. Oh yeah, my ACCE might call or might even show up, and it's a very expensive visit because I'm paying the same credit hours whether I'm in, you know, in a local you know, hospital or I'm in my classroom. And so we said, why don't we move some of the classroom out to the field? And so what we did was we started a learning management system, an LMS, built around a platform that said, we're going to move radiology, we're going to move grand rounds, we're going to move pharmacology, we're going to move you know, case studies and facilitation and integration while you're in the field, so that instead of spending 40 hours in a clinic, the example you gave is you know, prescient, you know, exactly the six patients in all modalities. Say, okay, even if the clinic's doing that for 10 hours a week, we're going to do labs, and you're going to be given additional time to take an online facilitated course with your colleagues throughout the country, may or may not be the same PT school, in radiology, pharmacology, grand rounds, case studies, mentors, you know, very cohort-driven stuff that you see in MBA programs and you see in the real world. You know, what we fail in PT school oftentimes is not the book learning, but it's the tacit knowledge skills, getting along with others, collaboration, empathy, communication, listening skills, empowerment. And that's what we've tried to move in the model that we've tried to do. Fortunately, we also found a partner in South College that on the entry level, we said, you know, the residencies of today ought to be the entry level knowledge, competency, cognitive points of the future. And we said to them, we'd love to do a PT program using this model that we've been very successful in residency programs, moving classroom out to the field, blended approach, lots of labs, videos and lectures in advance, mentors, cohort-driven models, and let's see if we can get this done. And not only were we able to get it done, but we were able to get a program that is now taken from a 3-year DPT down to a 2-year DPT.
So let's talk about that for a little bit.
That's a genesis. Sure.
That's a big thing. That's a very big thing that I think probably hasn't really set in for a lot of places yet. The setting up and you were accredited, correct?
Yes, yeah.
From what I've read, you went through the stage the first time and you didn't get accredited, and then you had to go through it again and then you were accredited.
Well, I think technically, and again, I'm not an expert in accreditation, but it's called candidacy status. I guess you don't get fully accredited until you graduate your first class, and that's not unique to our program. That's just, you know, how the system works.
Right, just terminology, right?
Yeah, so we're candidacy status, and then you get full accreditation upon your first graduating class. And when we went through it the first time, we got denied. And you know, there's two ways you could take it: failure, okay, let's bitch and moan and complain and call our congressman, or let's take their criticism to heart and say, how can we make it better? And that's resiliency. And so we came back stronger. much better program, much more thought, conscious. If you look at medical schools and certainly law schools, there is a growing trend of higher intensity, lower time period. Pharmacy is the exact same way.
And we physicians' assistants.
Yeah, PA. Why can't we do this the same way? Why do we need why does it have to be a 3-year program? Well, fortunately, the requirements don't say it needs to be a 3-year program. And you alluded to something earlier, which was, we do these rotations and all of a sudden, no, this is too much of an ortho program. Well, then really the CAPTI standards don't specify you need to do X amount of neuro, X amount of ortho, X amount of peds, X amount of geriatrics. They just say you need to have a broad, experience in that. You need to meet the requirements. So we took that to heart and came back and fortunately, when CAPTI met with us, looking at our cadre of PhD PTs, if you look at the number of publications coming out of South College, a very new program, you can check my math on this, but you're going to find very few PT programs in the United States that out of the gate will have as many published research through a broad range of orthopedics and healthcare economics. John just had a study this past week in BMC that has a number of peer-reviewed journal publications that the EIM School of Physical Therapy at South College has.
Yeah, I'll take your word for it. There's no math allowed on this show. the big point. So you've mentioned when you were talking about the genesis of EIM and even this program, which I think was the natural progression of EIM to what you're starting out now, is the lack of real world connection between kind of a traditional setup from PT programs to what it takes to grow in physical therapy now. Right. So if we're teaching students what we're teaching them now, they're going to be physical therapists of yesteryear, of the information that was developed before, versus changing with the times and evolving, incorporating more technology and evidence-based practice, if you will. But really delivering how to be a therapist in the world versus just how to treat a person. And it sounds like that's what your program is really trying to do. Is I'm guessing probably with 2 years they're also going to have not as big of a bill come to graduation time, which is one of the big things that was mentioned in the last podcast pretty much universally, is the student loan debt. But it's actionable education for them. Let me ask you, this might be a bit of a weird or interesting question depending on the perspective. If you were pitching it to yourself, right, if you said, okay, Larry, we're going to do a 2-year DPT program, how would you react to that?
Well, I guess the first big question I'd ask is, why was there ever a 3-year? I had somebody ask me at a conference. I spoke at a conference in Washington the other year, like 3 weekends ago, and they said, "Why can you reduce it down to a 1-year?" And obviously it becomes a slippery scale. But let me first start off by telling you that this is all very selfish. It's with self-interest. Now, I don't mean that from a profit standpoint. But my big concern, I think if you talk to Tim Flynn, Rob Wehner, John Childs, our big concern is how can we assure that the best and brightest become the next generation of PTs? Let me tell you that I think we have some incredibly bright, I'm just so fortunate and blessed to be able to speak to so many DPT students at PPS and CSM and some of the ones that are very, very active and already in the PPS section and through their student conclave. We really do have some incredible kids coming into the profession.
I feel like it's more and more every year for sure, more and more interactive and just more excited to speak with clinicians that have been out and, that are putting themselves out, like you and a bunch of others like Jared Durham that's been on the podcast, and then Wendell and Stefania Bell. I feel like before you see all these people and you just kind of want to go, oh my God, these are people that have hundreds of clinics and they're doing this and that. But now the students are like, let me send them a Twitter message or let me reach out and say hello. And I'm with you. I mean, I think it's great. That interaction, yeah. I think, is the best part of.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you want is, when the recession hit and high student debt, salaries that have not kept in lockstep with rising tuition. When you have kids that have entered the profession without regard to student debt, and salary, you know you're getting a good kid. You know you're getting a good student. So you want those. But in a very self-serving way, how can we assure that long term? And to me, the only way was to make sure over the long term, because I think the debt crisis is very much like the mortgage crisis. And when it hits, it's going to hit hard. So how can I assure the best and brightest are not going to be deterred by a couple $100,000 student debt? And with a two-year program priced accordingly, and we're very disruptive and irrelevant, and what we said is we're passing that cost on, or passing that savings on, really, to the student. And if they do a one-year internship at the end of this, their net out of pocket is going to be in the $40,000 range. That's complete total cradle to grave, soup to nuts pricing, which is but competitive by any standard imaginable.
That's not bad. There you go. You heard it first. Go through Larry's program for $20.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. We're getting applicants now. Our first, I think we're allowed to take 60 in our first group, where we eventually want to get to 100. We think this whole idea that you can only take 15 or 30 or 40 students is just silly. But we have some limitations on our first group, it's hitting these. We're getting folks that are pivoting, literally from a 3-year program where they're paying $60,000-$70,000 a year to our programs, and 2 years. Wow, that's unbelievable. So, we're very, very encouraged by that. We also think there's some sort of psychosocial issues involved. We think that we know private practices and folks all over the country that say, this person would have been a perfect PT, but they couldn't get accepted into school. Well, when you have 50 applications or 25 applications for every one slot, what is the default? The default to a traditional public university is who's going to graduate, who's going to complete the program, not who's going to be the best PT. It's an economic financial decision by a school. What we're trying to be the program is who's going to become the best PT, who's got the best combination of grit, emotional intelligence, confidence, and the gift of imperfection and empathy that can relate to a patient who can handle the academic rigor, because certainly under any circumstances, PT is a rough academic curriculum.
Sure.
But we want the best and brightest, not necessarily the 4.0 student who's never gotten a B in their life, who just happens to want to become a PT.
So do you also differentiate yourself in kind of what we discussed earlier is the business side of it as well, right? Because you are a good businessman, right? Even though you have military precision with lining up your business, it's still everything your history of development with the IM and your clinics before, it's a good business play. Like, and same thing with this, it with all the positives that come out of it, just stepping back, it's a great business proposition. It's a great system, and if it takes off and you can franchise it maybe and develop other programs or hopefully grow, right? If you can do a 2-year DPT program and pass those savings on. But how do you integrate teaching kids about healthcare, teaching them about starting a practice, some of the stuff that we've talked about before that seems lacking so much in the programs now?
Yeah, no, I think that that if you're sort of referring to, well, we have more business related courses, I can't honestly tell you that. I don't know offhand what the CAPTI requirement is. I think the majority of our students will be doing 1-year, terminal internship, entry level residencies in private practices, so they're going to get that through osmosis, through exposure. I think our whole approach is very MBA-like in that we're going to put them in cohort groups according to strengths. Part of their admission criteria is going to be based on an exhaustive strengths measure to try to put them in teams. So it's got sort of the cohort-driven MBA style to it. We're going to be doing lots of mentoring, coaching, facilitation, to get them there. And I think what you're going to see, I might be wrong about this, of course, everybody who's in private practice, who's not in private practice, automatically thinks you're doing it for a profit motive. Certainly we want to make profit in doing this. We wouldn't be doing it otherwise, but that's not our main priority or main menu. It never is. Any successful business is successful not because they've, gone out and profit has been their main motive. It's because profit's been secondary, tertiary, or way down the line. They want to make a difference. They want to do something better. They wanted to invent a new mousetrap. And I think what you're going to see, I might be wrong about this, and this will be interesting playback in a few years, but you're going to see other PT programs come out and go to a two-year model like we have. And I encourage it. I absolutely encourage it. You know, as you all know, there's all kinds of stages that your competitors go through. So, you know, right now people are looking at us and they're ignoring us. Oh, those EIM guys are a bunch of arrogant pricks. They're a bunch of academic folks who think they want to make money. And therefore, okay, they've got a two-year program. So they're just, you know, they sort of ignore you. Then they kind of laugh at you. Oh, yeah, they're doing a two-year program. That's a joke. They'll never get approval. They'll never get candidacy status. Okay, now we've got candidacy status. So then they attack us. You know, then they go, oh, well, it's wrong. Flipped education won't work. Their students won't be prepared. They'll be inferior students. They're ruining the profession, you know. And then what happens after that is then they, you know, then they start to imitate you and they'll go to a two-year program. And then, of course, the last stage is they claim they invented the two-year program. Oh, we were working on that two-year program long before EIM was ever even a name in the industry. So that's kind of the stages that we anticipate.
So you've never heard of criticism, have you?
No.
So let's talk about that, Larry, because I feel like that's the question on my mind is what's it going to do to the PT profession as a whole? And I think that for right or wrong, part of going to a 3-year doctoral program was to align ourselves with you know, what was Vision 2020 and to make physical therapists recognized as a first choice provider for musculoskeletal disorders and to gain some respect in the medical field. And I think that going to that doctoral program, part of that was that third year. So and I know that was 1993 that we started with doctoral program. So, what do you think it does to the profession going back to a 2-year program now?
Well, first, you know, I would challenge your assumption there, and I don't mean to be in any way critical towards you personally, but if you really look, I think in the mid 80s, I think it was Creighton University who first came with the doctorate program. So the move to a post professional doctorate had zero to do with APTA. It had everything to do with the schools wanting to, extract additional dollars and profits from students. APTA had Vision 2020 and moved towards a doctoring profession, but the marketplace itself had long since gone there. So if you really look historically, APTA moved everybody and said, by this particular date, we want all programs to be an entry-level master's. And when they came out with that decree, it was, you know, my guess is 20 years before that became reality. Then in a very, very short period of time, it moved towards a doctorate, not because of APTA, but because the schools moved it and found an additional way to extract dollars. If you look at any other programs, they've done the same thing, everything from accounting to pharmacy to audiology to what would be another example? Any program where you've seen that used to be a bachelor's is now a master's, in general, those weren't driven by the profession. They were driven by schools. So you have to take that, you know, criticism seriously. So then you look at it and you say, well, 3 years, CAPTI never said 3 years. That's what the schools just sort of decided. And then instead of 20 years, which became the master's decree, the DPT became a very fast, because all the schools wanted to copy the other schools, because in particular the private sector, because it became additional sources of revenue. The state schools were the ones that were delayed on that because they require legislative approval. And I think, what was it, Texas and California were two of the last states to come aboard. So that was not driven by APTA, thankfully. And that's not a criticism towards APTA. It's the reality. It's an accolade towards them. It's really the schools. So the 3-year thing was never CAPTI. It was never driven by the profession. So nobody went to CAPTI and challenged them and said, you know, there's enough the content is such that if in a modular way and if appropriate, it can be moved towards a 2-year. If you look in the medical schools and the law schools, a lot of them are doing the same thing. I think it was Dartmouth. Don't quote me on that, but I think it was Dartmouth went from a four-year medical school to a three-year. Now, what they did was they didn't pass any savings on for 3 years. They just charged the same thing they did in 4 to 3. But so keep in mind that was – so the criticism shouldn't be towards the profession or APTA. It should be really towards the schools and in their ability to try to extract additional revenue sources from students.
Larry, I have a question about the curriculum. I really enjoy your – I only read the blog post, actually. I didn't attend either the webinar or the seminar about placebo and nocebo, and I think that's very, very important. And a lot of I think the audience for that isn't nearly as big as it should be, but everyone who basically interacts with patients needs to hear that message from clinicians and especially students. And students are always telling me, you know, I wish I had more pain science in my curriculum. I wish I had more of it in my curriculum. Do you include it in the entry-level DPT curriculum?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, placebo, nocebo, empathy, communication skills, listening skills, positive psychology. Now we're in this implicit bias patterning that we're going to be very huge proponents of in the PT program. And we even exhibit placebo and nocebo responses, even when we don't intend to. We exhibit implicit bias, even when we, you know, cognitive biases, even when there, you know, we have. So what we have to teach PTs is that biases are reality. Placebo is reality. How can we create sort of metacognition, thinking about thinking, and in spite of that input, interrupt that and intervene appropriately? And I know that's getting a little bit deep in the woods, you know, from a psychological perspective. But you know, I'll give you an example. I taught a course on the positive psychology interventions in PT at CSM, and you know, after about a minute or two of kind of general diatribe and self-promotion, of course, you know, I mentioned to them that at the end of this that I would be doing a quiz, and they would be submitting their answers by smartphone, and that the person who got the highest scores would get a prize, would get an award. Well, you know, then towards the end of the lecture, I, you know, simply told everybody that was bullshit, that I was just saying that. And in fact, the placebo response is such that by just making people think that they had to respond to a quiz and pay attention will promote and influence them in a positive way to retain and be able to spit back the information better than had I not told them there would be a quiz. Now, I could have even told them right after that there's going to be a quiz and, oh, okay, no, I'm just kidding. There really won't be a quiz. Even if I did that, which is telling you you have a placebo but also telling you that it is a placebo, that will also influence it in a positive direction. So we can't deny the phenomenon. And what's been interesting in PTs, there's been sort of this, like, you know, this chest bumping, this, you know, coat of armor that basically says, oh, placebo is a bad thing. The only thing that can influence positive results is my direct interventions and my hands-on skills and my science and my EVP. Well, the reality is you want to, as Tim Flynn and I like to say, you want to be able to, you know, influence placebo, mitigate nocebo, and definitely have positive outcomes through your interventions and EBP. But so it's a combination, I think, really of, and this is my company's value proposition, it's a combination of clinical excellence, the EBP, if you will. It's a combination of customer service and collaborating and being of service and support to your patients. And lastly, it's the service excellence. It's the compassion, kindness, positivity, and empathy. It's those three things working in concert with one another that we really believe will have the most magnified benefits, that will create physical therapy as the differentiator, as the positive deviant in a healthcare system that's just, you know, consumed with utilization, drugs, opiates, and x-rays, you know, imaging. And we think we're going to be the difference maker. And we believe that our students at the entry level, just as they are in our residency and our fellowship and our clinical training, that those are the ingredients and the components that'll facilitate it in the most positive way.
How do you teach empathy and communication to students that's real world?
No, it's a great question. Well, empathy is a multidimensional construct. So the first component of empathy is that you have to have non-judgment. And that relates to what I was talking about a few minutes ago, which is to say that, the biggest problem we have in physical therapy is our bias and our judgment, our heuristics, our stereotypes. And so it's a real skill to learn non-judgment. You learn that through mindfulness, through listening skills, through what we call exquisite empathy, through what we call emotional handling. So non-judgment is sort of the foundation, you know, that we teach. And then we, you know, empathy is both a cognitive skill. Everybody thinks it's a genetic skill. It's really more of a thinking skill. So we have to teach perspective taking, which is, you know, walk a mile in somebody's moccasins. You have to teach emotional empathy, which is I feel your pain. And then pro-social concern, which is that last component, which is what PTs are very good at, problem solving, coming up with solutions. And so empathy is both a skill that can be taught, but it's also an experience that has to be learned. So you influence empathy, ironically enough, through humanities, not through medicine, but through appreciation of art and culture and in music and literature and other areas that people individually have sort of a penchant for. And, you look at medicine right now, and there's a variety of, you know, companies and universities teaching empathetics. In PT, we, you know, our version of it is entitled Call to Care. And so it very much can be taught. There's a number of scales for it. The Jefferson scale out of Philadelphia is probably the most common one. We have great evidence. There's now been a systematic review of empathy that was just produced here pretty recently. And what we know is physicians generally lose it when they're in medical school. So you become when you graduate from medical school, your empathy is actually less than when you came into the career. We really believe PTs are called and have an idea around meaningful work. So purposeful, meaningful work, generally a better place to, you know, better place to be. We think PTs have a more natural inclination towards it, but it has to be taught, experienced.
I think the hard part is for a lot of students and programs, I feel like, is the differentiation between empathy and sympathy. And I think it's a very fine line, but I think it's a fine line that separates two worlds. And I think it's very easy to feel bad for somebody before you even meet them, because they're coming to see you because they're going to be either in pain or just with a dysfunction. Something is not typical for them to come see you. So I think most students feel like they need to have that sympathy for them. But for anyone that's been a patient or a customer or a consumer in anything, you know, nobody wants, or most people don't want you to feel bad for them. They want you to understand what they're going through. Just like if you go to a store, you want the retail employee to understand why you're there and what you want to purchase from them, and you want help from them in getting that, which sometimes you don't know. If you walk into Best Buy, you want to know, and you know you need a laptop, but you don't really know what laptop to buy. You don't want the person coming up to you saying, "Oh, you know, I'm sorry, you have to buy a laptop. It sucks that your other one broke." Oh, you know, I've had my laptop break as well. Let me show you how to pick one out and what you need to do to get the best one for you. And which is a tough thing, I think, for a lot of people to really know and figure out how to deal with that.
No, absolutely. And that's a component of it. You know, I'll be at Northern Arizona University in a couple weekends, and they're doing an interesting study on PT students that's looking at factors that we addressed earlier, such as grit and empathy, and tracking it through their lifespan of a student.
For some reason, as soon as you said they're doing a study on DPT students, for some reason I just imagined a DPT student in a hamster wheel just running.
Yeah.
Was I the only one? Was I the only one that pictured that?
Yeah. I imagined him more on like a, you know, James Bondy type table, getting like with a laser going laser towards him or something. Yeah.
All right, I derailed this on that one.
Movie references, yeah.
So, I completely lost that train of thought for everyone, but
no, it's okay. No, the point is we have to do. You know, I will say this though. Again, students get blamed for a lot of things, but it isn't the students that I see that are the empathy problems. It's the ones that are so geared on trying to objectify everything for their patients and to rationalize everything based on some, you know, Cochrane database or meta-analysis to a patient who can care less. You know, you talk about empathy. The empathy is thinking the patient really cares about your science background in definitions and support, and factual responses to their emotional or non-factual questions.
And that's a big statement coming from a guy that is military-based and built a evidence-based foundation company. You know, that says a lot that you can you should have that integration between the two. It's fine to follow science and evidence, but if you don't have that human component to it, if you're a robot spewing science, nobody wants to see that. Nobody wants to talk to a robot. People want to have genuine human interaction and communication and enjoy that experience as much as possible.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, on a Strength Finders exam, I'm probably there's 34 strengths. Empathy is probably number 34 for me. So this is not, this is not a discovery that comes easy for me. So, but as a seeker of sort of the scientific side of it, you can't deny the critical, psychosocial issues that go and that influence positive outcomes. You know, I spent, it's almost been 2 years now, but I spent a year, going back every one weekend a month at University of Pennsylvania in a program called MAP, Masters in Applied Positive Psychology, because I've always been sort of, perplexed by what are the non-clinical factors of clinical success. You know, I'm from the early days when the Boeing studies came out. And the Boeing studies basically showed that if you had a workers' comp injury and you were out for, a couple of days and your employer called you and said, man, we miss you, come back, get better quickly, that from a workers' comp perspective, that had more of a bearing on whether you returned to work than just about anything else. And so I've always known that as a military guy, we had a subset of the population that, we were allowed to, get x-rays when we were in the military. We had a subset of the population, you got an x-ray, oh, it's normal. Okay, great. There's nothing wrong with me then. And so what are these placebo, nocebo, these, non-biomedical models, psychosocial models that really influence care? And oftentimes PTs are unwilling to admit that it is more than just our, evidence-based practice rationale. You know, patients that went to physical therapy long before, the advent of EBP and science as an improvement, patients did get better in PT. And it wasn't always because they had the best, evidence at that particular time. So we have to be very, very careful about, this sort of, spectrum of, one end to the other. And I think the implications, the unintended consequences of a profession too hell-bent on proving everything to everybody is that we suddenly lose, the idea that we got a human being on the other end.
I mean, I think I like that, one of the things I always talk about in my seminars is that I say that EBP means evidence-based police. And I think especially on social media, there's a lot of guys out there who are just so vigilant about where's the evidence, where's the evidence? Every time you post something, where's the evidence? And, even if I could post evidence, there's so many studies that just aren't even validated. And I could always tell in someone who's either going through an EIM program or has gone through one, because just the way they argue or the way that they interpret the evidence, they talk about the pillars and they think the pillars are important as opposed to just, the pillars, forget about that. It's only all about the evidence, it has to be 100% evidence. I mean, I don't understand that approach. And, one of my favorite blog posts by Lorimer Mosley was that a lot of his students who were going through the Explain Pain programs, they were just having so much trouble with this woman. And finally, someone asked her, why do you think this is not working? She said, well, I'm just so fragile. It's because they forgot to touch her. And I think that when you take any one thing, like Explain Pain or therapeutic neuroscience education or however you want to term it, and you just go all in with it, like many people tend to do, and that's the new thing now, you forget that it does require, you still need to move, you still need to touch people, and you need to kind of use everything that is proven to work and not just whatever is currently in vogue.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. So I have this checklist that I tell all my therapists about, all my companies. And nothing on this checklist has anything to do with the science of evidence-based practice. Doesn't mean that it's not important. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't use it. But did the patient leave having felt cared for? Yes, no. Did the patient feel having left listened to? Yes, no. Did the patient feel having left affirmed? Yes. having felt like it was a good experience and knowing what went well. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's the simple things. It's the, you know, what I call proxies, or this sort of idea that a patient feeling listened to and cared for on top of evidence-based practice, the best evidence for that patient at that particular time, is going to get the best care. And that's ultimately what we have to differentiate ourselves in PT, because ultimately at the end of the day, what's different about us than other professions? Well, we listen to patients, we put our hands on patients, we explain things to patients, we listen to them, and then we help them, you know, prevent things down the road. And we can get all caught up in the textbooks and everything else, but at the end of the day, it's our profession has, you know, it's gone on since the Reconstruction AIDS, and that is a patient and a therapist behind a door, one-on-one, and how have they been cared for.
And I think that pretty much sums it up, right? It's, again, it's that, that one-on-one understanding of the person in front of you. And, well, I can't wait to see how your program evolves. I think it's always, we, regardless of professions, I think just as human beings, we like comfort zones, and, you know, we get established and we like to stick with that. And we, even more so when we have, you know, some skin in the game of that, which is obviously the whole point of disrupting our marketplace is all about. It's you're going to have detractors because you're hitting them where it's going to hurt in the bottom line. So I'm definitely excited to see where your program goes and how it evolves, because everything always evolves, and work out the kinks, and as it gets better, it'll be cool to keep track of. And but you know, with all the stuff that you have in terms of expertise, that we didn't even scratch the surface of owning clinics and healthcare and all of that stuff that, I'm sure a lot of our listeners would love to hear from you with the, you know, with your background of being a private practice owner of how many, at would you say at the largest point, how many clinics did you, or have you owned at once?
Well, right now we have, in about the mid 60s in, Oklahoma, Texas, Indiana, Kentucky, North Carolina. And on top of that, we have Evidence in Motion and a company called Fit for Work, which does all on-site, mostly workers' comp mitigation, you know, direct access, post-offer work screens, early intervention services. So that keeps us pretty busy.
Yeah. Sounds like I'm sure it does.
100% owned by private practice PTs and OTs. So we're very proud of that, and are going to continue to grow and have fun and be irreverent and be disruptive.
That's the way it should be. You know, that's, if we can do that, why not? Especially if it improves the profession and helps us get better overall. But the point of that is, I mean, I would love to have you back and just spend some time just talking about that, setting up private practice and, sure, and insurance, and, you know, your thoughts on cash-based versus out-of-network, all that stuff that we've talked about. It would be great to get a perspective from somebody that has that.
I'd love to do that, because we're now entering the retainer-based, the concierge world. And I'm a late adopter of that. You can tell by my history that there's you know, oftentimes I'm on the front end edge of the curve, sometimes too early and fail.
Well, you are a military guy, so.
Yeah, right. And then there's other times where I'm you know, on the back end, but not realizing that we're moving ahead. So I've been I finally looked pretty seriously at the cash-based world over the last 4 or 5 months, and I've really drawn a variety of opinions on it, and was frankly very disappointed in what I saw, in the sense that, you know, I think there's a number of people who claim they're in the cash-based world, but they're really trying to make money on how to tell people that they're really in the cash-based world. There are those who are really in the cash-based world, and the last thing they're doing is out trying to tell people how to be in the cash-based world. There's very few that I've seen, if any, that are in the retainer-based sort of concierge world, that where I think our best value proposition is. And we're just about to enter it, so I don't have any experience in it, but I can tell you what our thought and our wisdom is behind it. I've been in private practice since 1987, and you know, had 70 locations the first time around, and now I'm on the second time around, and I can talk about sort of the consolidation in the world and what investors think of the PT world and where we're at with all that. But I'll leave that for another call at another time.
Perfect. I think that's If that's not a tease that somebody will want to listen, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
I want to listen to that.
Exactly. I'm tempted to just say go. Just go. We'll just record it and we'll hit stop in an hour. Just tell us when you're done. But final thoughts, Urs?
I think when I first heard about your 2-year program, I was really excited, and I remember talking to a few of my colleagues, and one of them just came back with, "Oh, I'm really disappointed that it's a private, it's a company as opposed to an institution or university." And I just didn't even know where that was coming from. I was really surprised at that. I guess hearing you talk about the different phases of, being disruptive, and I know I kind of experienced that with the whole edge mobility system. It does happen. But I was surprised because I just didn't think. I just thought I was excited by it. And
yeah, so, no, I appreciate that. If anybody is looking at the public nonprofit universities to be the, to be the leading generators on how to reduce cost and improve a product, they're looking at the wrong place.
What about you, Joe?
And I really appreciate you coming on, Larry, and talking about the program. I think it can be a good thing. I'm like Gene. I can't wait to see where it goes. And I'm gonna call up Baltimore and see if I can get my refund check. I'll let you know how that goes. We're gonna do hashtag DPT refund.
There you go.
Year refund. That's right.
And we'll see if I can get my third year back.
Yeah, well, maybe you'll get that before I get the steak from John Childs.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and recommend that nobody holds their breath because we will all be dead. So, yes, sharing Joe's sentiment. Larry, thanks for joining us. And I'm dead serious that would love to have you back and talk about the business side of it. The 2-year program, I think, is the potential of it is so the positives of the potential outweigh the negatives that I see. And with the way the residencies program, the programs are growing, my clinic having developed one in Maryland, being the first accredited one in Maryland, I think our governing body, the APTA, is so inclined to have private practices run residencies. I don't see why a business that is so experienced like yours with developing programs and teaching it can't succeed and should be frowned upon in terms of having a program. Business is a business. I don't see why, what the downside, the negative of somebody having a business and developing a program. I feel like a lot of times we have to apologize for wanting to make a profit or wanting to have a successful business. But like you said, making some money and having a successful business doesn't mean you're putting out a subpar product. It's quite the opposite. You have to do better. You have to have the best product possible to have that success, to make that money, not the other way around. So I'm definitely looking forward to it. And thanks for coming up and chatting with us.
I can just encourage you to keep at it, man. You're doing great.
And we will. So if you have any questions, shoot it Larry's way at Physical Therapy on Twitter. Shouldn't be too hard to remember.
Yes, he can answer anything in the world about physical therapy.
Anything at all.
Yes.
Including military formations. If students or anybody that's listening is interested in the program that we keep talking about, where can they find out more information?
Yeah, sure. South College has a website. I couldn't tell you what it is offhand. We've got a number of links on the Evidence in Motion blog, or they can simply Twitter me at Physical Therapy. I'm not afraid to give out my email. My email is larry@physicaltherapist.com. Maybe you can ask me next time how I got the domain physicaltherapist.com. That would be a good opening.
Done. I'm making a note now, jotting it down. All right, here we go. Ask Larry about domain. Got it. Great. And so I'll put all of Larry's stuff on the website as well, therapyinsiders.com.
We'll do the same. We'll put it on Evidence in Motion's website. Once you get the podcast posted, I'll put down a couple of my reflections on there as well, and hopefully drive some traffic your way.
Very much great. Appreciated. And
thank you very much.
If you haven't heard the last podcast with the 3DPT students, I'd recommend it, mostly because I did it and I spent a lot of time editing. But aside from that, I think that it was cool hearing perspectives from students, and we talk about students a lot. And I know we're big on not just talking, but actually doing something about it. So getting them to talk about it and seeing the similarities and some of the concerns and things like that was really cool. And I think, as Larry said, you know, the next generation is the really important one for us, because we see some of the stuff that's going on and how we want to fix it. And sometimes you kind of have to start from the beginning. We'll catch up with Larry another time from in between his millions of things that he's got going on, and we'll talk some business.
Great. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks, Larry.